All right. Hello, everyone. We're here with Michael Mead. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
Hi. Thank you for being with me today to speak about soul activism. I just want to introduce you with a short bio.
For those of you who don't know Michael Mead, he's a renowned storyteller, author, and scholar of mythology, anthropology, and psychology. He combines hypnotic storytelling, street-savvy perceptiveness, and a spellbinding interpretation of ancient myths with a deep knowledge of cross-cultural rituals. He has an unusual ability to distill and synthesize these disciplines, tapping into ancestral sources of wisdom and connecting them to the stories we're living today. I just wanted to begin by giving a little bit of background to my request for this interview. I was what most would probably call a traditional activist from a very young age, from my teens, and I'm not even sure where that actually came from in me. I know that you often say that we're not born a tabula rasa or an empty slate, and that was definitely my experience in this realm of my life. In my mid-20s, I turned more fully towards personal healing, and living my calling became more of a focus. And since the intensification of politics, I've been really experiencing a crisis of conscience and confusion about what is enough. And a good amount of critic attack has really arisen in these recent times. So I'm bringing my questions and my struggles to this interview and to the commons in hope that they can serve a larger conversation.
Well, the first thought that comes to mind is what I often say when I'm working in oppressed communities, which is that healing is a revolutionary act. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, one problem is people won't commit, take a stand, be an activist in a time when activism is required. The other problem is when people commit so fully to some form of activism that they burn out or even wind up kind of isolated while being active. So the term soul activism, soul being the connective tissue of the world and the missing ingredient in most endeavors, would suggest somehow holding together the inner world and the outer world, I would say. And so in you know, years of working with communities of color and homeless people and at-risk youth and so on, one of the things I notice is how often the people taking the lead and being the most active, including myself at times, would burn out. Mm-hmm. And then what happens, unfortunately, is there comes a critical moment where you could do a lot of good just because timing works out a certain way and you're too burned out to show up. Mm-hmm. So there's a balance there that can only be learned by trial and error, I think. So I guess another part of that would be another way in which healing is a revolutionary act is healing oneself contributes healing to the planet, you could say. I become a more whole human being. My actions become more wholehearted, and that affects people around me. So I like the term soul activism. And then I think over the course of one's life, the process of being actively engaged in change and healing and bringing justice to various communities changes. I started out also with classic activism in the 60s, being in the street, being against war and against oppression and things like that. Wound up in jail, as a matter of fact, which was really radically changing. In other words, I thought I was out there changing the system, which was true to some effect, but it wound up being a radical change in me that happened. And so when I talk to young people now and encourage young people, you know, to be active and to get involved, I would say there's two things going on. You join an activist movement and you are stepping into the rapid stream of life, and that's important to do as a step of, you know, human growth. But in the midst of the being active, figure out which part of you. In other words, there's an initiatory quality, I think, to activism. I think that's one reason it's so appealing. You're actually doing something. You're actually trying to change something, and those are can be initiatory moves. But the critical thing in the midst of any initiation is to engage one's deeper self. And so I often think that collective forms of activism are the beginning of what can turn into unique forms of initiation for a person. So that's one thing. The other thing I think that's going on now is there's no single thing to be activist about. I mean, there's climate change, probably the biggest thing going on, but climate change has so many issues and so many, you know, specific problems that the question becomes, where are you going to engage it? Because where we get fully engaged is where we can have the most effect. But we're also living in a time when every area of culture needs activists. And so I think we might be in a period of having to redefine activism. And I like to redefine it by aligning it with calling.
Right.
If I can figure out my calling and move in that direction, I'm going to be more effective in terms of healthy activism, because I'm going to be more naturally empowered and more inspired. So that's why I wrote The Genius Myth, the book about genius, because I'm trying to suggest that we're in a period of such necessary activism that the genius of all kinds of people are needed, and that there's no one answer, there's no one program, there's no one ideology, there's no single movement. There's actually the potential for activism based on the genius of many, many different people, and that's what's needed because of the complexity of the issues.
Right. So in that way, activism is an outgrowth of calling. They're not separate for you.
Well, I think they entwine. I would have to say, honestly, I mean, I've been involved in various activist adventures for a long time, and I've seen people who were very committed activists be not very developed people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the outward titling, if it's not combined with the revolution, the inner revolution of healing, and if it's not aligned with a genuine calling, can actually backfire. I mean, how many revolutions throughout the world wind up producing tyrannical leaders?
Mm-hmm.
So you wind up with someone handling power that's not aligned with their calling. So I actually think it's pretty complicated. You know, like you were saying, it's one thing, we can donate to meaningful causes. That's a great thing to do. We can show up for major rallies, which is also a great thing to do. But when it comes to being active in a consistent basis, it's going to work best if I'm in a field where I'm naturally inclined, where my inner Dharma can be awakened, right? Using Dharma in the old sense, two parts, the inner law of my being and the way I'm best able to serve the world. I've also met people working as activists in a field where they're not good at it, and they don't know it. And so they actually can be mishandling things or getting very frustrated when it turns out they could be more effective in another area.
Right.
Like, I consider people doing meaningful healing work with other people at the end of their life, doing hospice work or something like that, I think they're activists. I think that's actually a radical form of activism that is based in some specific kind of capacity or gift. Mm-hmm. And, right? And so, and that can change a culture too. Yeah. Or if you take the case of elders, if you distinguish elders from elders, everybody gets old, but not everybody becomes an elder. And, you know, elders might not have the ability to run around to each protest. So what's the best thing for the elder to do? Get very deeply involved in the place they're in the issues of the place they're in, and also bring to bear the gifts that have become conscious and the abilities that have become practiced in their life.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. I'm just going to, I'm using myself as the template to kind of bring these questions, but so there are many ways I feel like I am, under that definition, a soul activist in the work that I do in the world. And yeah. But with what's been happening with the intensification of the political scene, it feels like there's more needed. And that somehow I have to listen, I don't even know if it's with another ear, but for what else is needed on top of what I'm doing. And, of course, I have to decipher between the critic that's just going to say it's never enough and a sense of, you know, intensification asking for more. And so I wonder if you could also speak to the critic in terms of how it can negatively impact our, you know, discerning process around this.
Well, yeah, I mean, I certainly have experienced the inner critic saying, I'm not enough, I'm not good enough, I'm not taking on enough. But
calling my representatives, if I'm not calling my representatives, then I'm not really, you know, there's this list of what's needed right now. And
yeah, that doesn't feel right to me. That feels like a separate issue in a sense. In other words, well, it feels like a little bit of a separate issue. In other words, so, you know, confidence turns out to be an important thing. I mean, some people have too much of it, Donald Trump, but, you know, having confidence in one's actions is not that easy to achieve. And it takes a kind of a lifelong internal review, which is maybe slightly different than the internal critic. I mean, the internal critic is connected with usually early life experiences of somehow being led to feel that we're not enough. So it's shame-based usually, I would say. And so that's something that has to be dealt with, because I think the dynamic of soulful, soul, the soul, remember soul is essentially about connection. So I love putting together something soulful with active, because soul means depth, right? Soul always has to go deeper. Spirit has to do with height, reaching the heights of spirit, but you reach the depths of soul. And soul is about deep knowing and deep resources. And so keeping soul next to the activism would be automatically kind of healing. And so it sounds like one of the healing things that's needed there, and I've come up against it too, is that this critic has too much power, you know, this critical voice. So what happens is that takes the soul out of it. Mm-hmm. If I'm calling my representatives because the critic is telling me if I don't do it, I'm a bad person. Well, I think the more serious problem is dealing with the critic than calling the, you know, right? Because here's the thing about it for me. The internal critical voice, what do you call that, erases or overcomes the internal inspired voice.
All right.
Right? And because the calling has an inner voice as well, well, more so than it has an outer one. And so the critic is kind of like a reverse calling. It's kind of the reversal of the calling. Because the calling says, you're gifted, you're meaningful, you're purposeful in a very unique way, and the things you have to give to the world are needed by the world.
Right.
The critic is saying, you're not good enough, you're not doing enough. So that's where I think healing becomes revolutionary.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I can heal the condition where I have an exaggerated critic, then I'm going to be a more whole person, a more soulful person, and I will be intuitively better and instinctively better in whatever the work is. You know,
right.
There are other people that have the opposite. I have Donald Trump on my mind, but because I think he's the symptom of the culture, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's why I think it's such a deal. It's like we've elected the symptom.
Right.
And America's narcissism has been elected.
Right.
So that gives us all a chance to work on it. And so when I look at him, I see not enough inner critic, right?
Right?
He should be able to say, geez, I think I've just been a national asshole, you know, and start apologizing. And then and that would be a wonderful thing to have a leader to do. And, of course, it would be a tremendous thing for him, but it would be healing for everybody. But he doesn't have enough of that inner critic that says, why did you just do that? You just offended people. You just scared people. So that's one problem. Then there's the rest of us who have too much of that inner critic. And I think the battle there, and that's why I think it does go back to calling. The battle there is I can never be a generally good person. There is no general good. I can only be specifically good in the circumstances I'm living in and the capacity I have.
Right.
So, you know, so like, I don't know if this helps, but I was working with Sudanese refugees for a number of years. They had actually come knocking on the mosaic door. And they were these big, tall, Nilotic young people from southern Sudan. And they said, someone said you could give us a drum. We need to dance.
Oh.
And so I began working with them. And I was able to create the circumstances for them to do their traditional dancing. And they were all from refugee camps. And they knew very little about their own culture, actually. And so I started researching the culture, and I could bring things to them and help deepen their understanding of their culture. And I was learning Dinka, and all this great stuff was going on. But in addition to that, they didn't have good housing. They had no health care. They didn't have good diets. And I started thinking, I'm not doing enough. I have to get them better housing. I have to find doctors who will volunteer to treat them. And I started, and Mosaic, we started trying to do this whole thing. And all of a sudden, we were all exhausted. It didn't work. And I had to pull back and say, no, I was helping them a lot by bringing them to the dance ground, by helping them be soulfully connected with each other on this ground, by actually becoming their mentor. I was doing a lot. And these other things that were needed, I couldn't do. I just couldn't do it. I don't even know how to do it. You know, so there was the critic erasing the thing that I was actually able to do and making me feel disempowered and not doing anyone any good.
That is
so,
an incredibly perfect story for this. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, there's this idea in terms of, I feel oriented more towards enriching culture, and then there's this whole question of the systemic changes that are needed, and that's not where my gifts lie, and that story is a beautiful example of just really going with where your gifts are. And the interesting thing is I'm birthing this day-long on soul activism, and as I've stepped towards it, you know, of course, the critic went insane in the beginning, and now it's quite much more quiet because I actually have, you know, said yes to the calling as opposed to yes to the critic, as you say, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And then what happens, I think, is you're on the road. If you're on the right road, you know, we keep falling off the path, but, you know, let's say we're on it as best we can. And that's a hard enough job. And we're doing that, and then what happens is you come to a point in the road, you were just following the thing that made most sense, trying to make, you know, me a better person in this world, and you reach an intersection where suddenly you're faced with a much bigger thing. So that, in other words, as I become more capable, yeah, it's great if I walk down, you know, the street with everybody else, you know, for human rights, for women's rights, for tribal rights, for climate change. That's all good stuff. And then the march is over. And and then if I'm an organizer, if I'm a political activist in the classic sense, well, I go right into the planning for the next thing. If I'm not, then I go back to the path I'm supposed to be on. And then one day it happens the path I'm on intersects with a need that's much bigger. And I'm prepared because I'm coming from the ground of my own soul, as opposed to trying to do something I'm not qualified for or instinctively good at. Right. And I think what's happened is the problems are so diverse, so intense, that everybody's going to, just by sticking with our own path, we're going to walk into the problems because they're in all directions now. When I started Mosaic, the whole point of Mosaic was to give back. I had had a period of surprising success, you know, being a storyteller, which, you know, for the most part, you know, you're not really employed. And I wanted to give back, and I thought, you know, how do I give back? And I thought, well, something I have a little bit of knowledge about is what it's like to be in trouble when you're young. And so Mosaic started with working with people, young people in trouble. And, you know, it was right on as a place to begin. And then over time, what's happened is everybody's in trouble. And so the project has just expanded. You know, I work with people trying to be elders. I work with, you know, people trying to find their calling. It's gone from literally working with young people to a broader sense of working with people in trouble and all kinds of trauma, to also working with people in all kinds of areas, working on what is the calling? How do I, you know, how do I follow the calling? So I think the first move is to move on a path that makes the greatest sense and deepen it, get more soulful with it. The rest takes care of itself. When I started Mosaic, the whole point of Mosaic was to give back. I had had a period of surprising success, you know, being a storyteller, which, you know, for the most part, you know, you're not really employed. And I wanted to give back, and I thought, you know, how do I give back? And I thought, well, something I have a little bit of knowledge about is what it's like to be in trouble when you're young. And so Mosaic started with working with people, young people in trouble. And, you know, it was right on as a place to begin. And then over time, what's happened is everybody's in trouble. And so the project has just expanded. You know, I work with people trying to be elders. I work with, you know, people trying to find their calling. It's gone from literally working with young people to a broader sense of working with people in trouble and all kinds of trauma, to also working with people in all kinds of areas, working on what is the calling? How do I, you know, how do I follow the calling? So I think the first move is to move on a path that makes the greatest sense and deepen it, get more soulful with it. The rest takes care of itself.
Yeah, I hear that. I'm just sitting as you're speaking of, you know, how the trouble has found its way into all areas. And I'm living in Marin, and there's a way that as troubled as the world is, and as much as we're all feeling it, you know, but there's still a level of dissociation or numbness or denial that any of us can be in. Yeah. And I think, you know, privilege can kind of create a buffer as well. And, of course, has its own challenges. But is there anything you can say about that in terms of, you know, when we're, you know, you said it's important that people take a stand. And, of course, the other end is not to burn out. But what happens when there's just kind of a collapsed numbness or denial or dissociation?
Well, it's really a hard thing to work with. You know, I live in a pretty privileged place, too, in the sense that I live on an island. And I've been continually surprised at how insulated everybody can be. And so, you know, that gets to be a tricky thing because, first of all, privilege has its own, you know, it may create numbness, but it's a heavy-duty shield also. So, you know, it's a strange thing for me. I gave up on trying to get privileged people to understand that most people in the world are suffering and that it's got to get around to knocking on their door, too. And so a strange thing that has happened is that way more people are aware of just how endangered the world is and how distorted life and punishing life can be for many people. But, yeah, there's still... So, I don't know. For me, being a storyteller, I just try to find the right story. I just find it, and then I try to tell... And I just tell it to the people who didn't want to hear it, you know, like the story of the old salt woman who's walking around the world with her grandchild, and then both of them are hungry, and they don't have a home either. And so they get to this village, and she goes to the first door. She could smell this good food being cooked and knocked on the door, and they say, you know, well, we can't give you food. We're too busy preparing a feast. Don't bother us. Mm. And, you know, and a bunch of things happen, and they have to leave, and she goes to another village, and there the people are poor. And when she knocks on the door, she can't smell anything. And they say, well, listen, we're really poor. We don't have much food. All we have is this very thin soup that we're going to share in it, but... You know, we understand poverty and we understand being lost in the world, so please join us. It won't be that satisfying. And they let her in. And then she's old salt woman, and this is early on in the world and before people knew about salt. So then she gives them salt, which turns the very bland soup into something tasty. Mm. And then she teaches them rituals. And so I tell that story to the privileged people, and, you know, they say, which house are you in? Are you in the house cooking for a feast and refusing to feed people that are hungry? Because if you are, you know, you're headed for even a bigger trouble than you think. So I don't know. That's the way I do it. I try to work with the story because otherwise I probably do illegal things.
So you go back to your gifts. It all goes back to the gifts.
Yeah, because then I can be standing on a ground that isn't pretentious and standing on a ground that... It's almost like a territory, and in the case of that story, it leads to ritual. So here's an interesting thing. So I've been doing ritual stuff for, 35 years, something like that, and mostly in communities of great need because people, they get it. They say, if we can all be together in some way that nourishes the soul, we don't care, you know, where the ritual comes from. We don't care. You know, we need a way to feel whole. But this year, I've been getting requests from yoga communities to do ritual. And I mean the classic kind of yoga that we see now in America, which is, you know, more middle class to upper class kind of taking care of my body and my stress kind of yoga. And, as if to say some realization is happening that I think yoga is a fantastic thing, so is meditation. But I think there may be some realization going that simply being on my mat, meditating and doing yoga may not be enough way of being in the world. Mm-hmm. And so that's cool too, because then... Through that door of ritual, all kinds of things can come. And so anyway, that's interesting to me in terms of sometimes you have to let the door of privilege open, or at least I found myself very discouraged and sometimes enraged from trying to knock on it and say, you need to change. And... So now, maybe the world's just gotten so bad that more of the doors will open.
Mm. Yeah, I've always been surprised, you know, knowing that you work so deeply with these issues and with oppression, and I never hear you use those words when you speak of power, privilege, oppression, and yet you're steeped in working with it and transmuting it, and I was always curious how your relationship with soul informs.
Well, it's really a hard thing to work with. You know, I live in a pretty privileged place, too, in the sense that I live on an island. And I've been continually surprised at how insulated everybody can be. And so, you know, that gets to be a tricky thing because, first of all, privilege has its own, you know, it may create numbness, but it's a heavy-duty shield also. So, you know, it's a strange thing for me. I gave up on trying to get privileged people to understand that most people in the world are suffering and that it's going to get around to knocking on their door too. And so a strange thing that has happened is that way more people are aware of just how endangered the world is and how distorted life and punishing life can be for many people. But, yeah, there's still – so, I don't know, for me – being a storyteller, I just try to find the right stories. I just find it, and then I try to tell, and I just tell it to the people who didn't want to hear it. You know, like the story of the old salt woman who's walking around the world with her grandchild, and then both of them are hungry, and they don't have a home either. And so they get to this village, and she goes to the first door. She can smell all this good food being cooked, and knocked on the door, and they say, you know, well, we can't give you food. We're too busy preparing a feast. Don't bother us. And, you know, and a bunch of things happen and they have to leave. And she goes to another village and there the people are poor. And when she knocks on the door, she can't smell anything. And they say, well, listen, we're really poor. We don't have much food. All we have this is a very thin soup that we're going to share in it. But, you know, we understand poverty and we understand being lost in the world. So please join us. It won't be that satisfying. And they let her in. And then she's old salt woman, and this is early on in the world and before people knew about salt. So then she gives them salt, which turns the very bland soup into something tasty. Mm. And then she teaches them rituals. And so I tell that story to the privileged people and, you know, and say, which house are you in? Are you in the house cooking for a feast and refusing to feed people that are hungry? Because if you are, you know, you're headed for even a bigger trouble than you think. So I don't know. That's the way I do it. I try to work with the story because otherwise I'd probably do illegal things.
So you go back to your gifts. It all goes back to the gifts.
Yeah, because then I can be standing on a ground that isn't pretentious and standing on a ground that it's almost like a territory. And in the case of that story, it leads to ritual. So here's an interesting thing. So I've been doing ritual stuff for, 35 years, something like that, and mostly in communities of great need because people, they get it. They say, if we can all be together in some way that nourishes the soul, we don't care, you know, where the ritual comes from. We don't care. You know, we need a way to feel whole. This year, I've been getting requests from yoga communities to do ritual. And I mean the classic kind of yoga that we see now in America, which is, you know, more middle class to upper class kind of taking care of my body and my stress kind of yoga. And as if to say some realization is happening that I think yoga is a fantastic thing, so is meditation. But I think there may be some realization going that simply being on my mat, meditating and doing yoga may not be enough way of being in the world. And so that's cool too, because then through that door of ritual, all kinds of things can come. So anyway, that's interesting to me. In terms of sometimes you have to let the door of privilege open, or at least I found myself very discouraged and sometimes enraged from trying to knock on it and say, you need to change. And so now maybe the world's just gotten so bad that more of the doors will open.
Yeah, I've always been surprised, you know, knowing that you work so deeply with these issues and with oppression, and I never hear you use those words when you speak of power, privilege, oppression, and yet you're steeped in working with it and transmuting it, and I was always curious how your relationship with soul informs, you know, that you could call that the very most literal layer of what's happening, and yet you hold it with some way of being able to bridge this literal layer and some much deeper thing that's happening in our culture.
Well, I just learned early on, I would just say, hey, you know, excuse me, you know, it looks to me like all these material goods and all these other things you have and these opportunities are making your life smaller. And it didn't work. And I wanted to do things that, in a sense, were radical, not simply in a political sense, but in a healing sense. And so the places where I could actually have the opportunity to learn and to grow myself and be helpful to other people were the places where everything was broken. And so that made more sense to me to just immerse in that than to... I've not seen a lot of success in knocking down the walls of privilege, and I noticed that I would become a more and more angry and frustrated person. Whereas if I step into something like working with suicidal young people, which I've done in all kinds of different, you know, layers of community, because you have suicidal issues with young people that are very wealthy now as well, all of a sudden, the issues are so big that I don't feel... I mean, all the privilege is out the window because the issue is so big. And so that's been my instinct. But I will say that even in recent years, trying to help the friends of suicidal young people and communities dealing with suicidal issues amongst young people, I have found privilege to be unbelievably insulated against change. And I've seen the damage that's causing to young people. But again, you know, it's very hard to, it's kind of like, if you think of it as healing is revolutionary, you know, it would be like a therapist going around and saying, oh, excuse me, I think you have a mother complex issue. You know, I've noticed how you behave. I think your relationship issues are actually going back to your mother. You know, they'll knock you down. So you have to wait until someone says, help, I need help. I learned that the hard way. So, yeah, so as things begin to eat away at people's privilege, then more people will be looking for help. And that's the first step in healing, and it's the first step in change, is acknowledging something's really wrong. And the problem with privilege is it pretends that nothing's wrong. The way I learned how to listen actually also had to do with being in the midst of undeniable, overwhelming pain, right? So it's another reason why I can't work very well in privileged situations, because I'm more effective if the pain is being acknowledged. And so as much as I have the habit of talking and in a sense love to talk, I've definitely learned that deep empathic listening to someone else's pain allows that pain to come much further out. And many people have never actually been heard. And that's why we call our project Mosaic Voices, because the inner voice of many people has never been heard. And I feel real fortunate that I got to, you know, the opportunity to do retreats and stuff. And then what I'm always trying to do, using story and poetry and stuff, and music and song and everything, to create a kind of ritual shape in which people are inclined to pour out the painful story or to express the trauma or the fear or whatever it is. And I'm really thankful that I've learned once that starts, all you have to do is listen, but you listen from your soul. And it turns out that everybody has access to the deepest emotions. I mean, I've worked with people in prisons and so on, and I've had people say, well, I don't know, I can't work with people that have had tragic experiences because I hadn't had them. Well, that's the voice of privilege all over again. Mm-hmm. Because what I've found, I don't have to have killed someone to be able to sympathetically, empathically listen to someone who has killed someone, either as a in a war situation, as a veteran, or in someone in prison, or whatever. I can listen from a place in me that knows that, even though I haven't experienced it. And it turns out that's what you have to do in order to create that empathic listening that allows the whole story to come out. I found that trauma is often being, post-trauma, post-traumatic issues are often being generated from a place in the psyche where the story hasn't been fully told.
Right.
And in working with battle veterans, that's almost always the case.
Mm.
They could be, I know, Vietnam era veterans who have never told their spouses or their children or anyone the absolute most traumatic story they're carrying. And yet the telling of that story is the beginning of the healing of it. And so I've just had to learn how to listen at that level. And then here's where the critic's voice comes in. If I don't do that on a given occasion, then the critic will say, well, who do you think you are? You're supposed to be a storyteller. You're supposed to be interested in healing, and you're not even listening from the depth of the soul. At that point, I have to listen to the critic because, And then there's this very strange thing. If you listen really deeply, somehow it activates a healing thing in oneself, because none of us have ever been fully heard.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes, so that's the listening to the other that creates healing really for everybody, for yourself and the person you're listening to.
To the other and suddenly you're hearing yourself better.
Right. And then there's the listening for where can I contribute, right? And I'm wondering if there's something you can also say about that kind of listening for people wondering, okay, I want to contribute and I don't know where to contribute. And so it's, it could be easy to just go to like, well, okay, there's a march next week. Okay, there's this. But what's that deeper listening so that we can each find where we truly belong in these times?
So, I don't know. I mean, everybody has to figure out. The interesting thing about the soul is it has distinct connections. And so another place where I learned something has been. So I go, I can get to tell stories and then I can talk a lot, And so people are listening. So I want to do it over here and I want to do it over there. And then I found out that didn't work. That it's a strange thing that I now know is connected to the old rules of being a storyteller, which is you have to be invited.
Mm.
And so one thing might be people not listening for the voice, the genuine voice of invitation.
Mm.
So this morning I got an email from a group of people working with opioid problems and the growing opioid addiction in the country. And it's not something I've ever been involved with. In other words, I've never taken opioids and never been addicted and all that. But they wanted me to come in and see if I couldn't bring a story that would help understand how to deal with it, because it's very tricky. And so I'm now in the process, even by talking about it, of the inner alchemy of listening to see whether I should be doing that or not.
Right. That's right? Exactly what I'm hoping you share more about. How do you listen to your own compass?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I mean, I just learn what I learn. So what happens to me often, if a story pops up, then I'm going.
Right.
You know, like someone says these aunties, these elders in a Native American reservation that I happened to meet at a conference and said, would you come and work with our youth? And that's a very daunting thing. I've worked on reservations. It's really the most painful place in the country I've ever found. But so if I go, yeah, sure, I'll be there. You know, like I might be acting in an overly heroic way. Mm-hmm. Or if I say, no, I can't take it, that could be that inner critic again. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how to trust either of those moves. But if a story pops up, then I go, yeah, I'm coming. Because I can ride on the story. Because it's not me myself. It's me having a story to offer. And then I know from experience when I offer the story, I've created a shared ground where I can meet people I don't know, where we can share with each other. But also, I've created a protection because we're inside the story. We're in the ground of story, which gives us a chance. And so so I just learned those little processes, like with this opioid thing. A story hasn't popped up yet. Well, actually, one little scene popped up, and so I have to go look at that story and see if that's what's trying to happen or not. So I'll base it on, I value the invitation, then I'll base it on, do I have a story connection, which I guess for me would be the soulful part of it. So I'm not showing up there as some pretentious person, or I'm not showing up there, you know, I don't know about it. They know more about it than me. So I will be arrived there wanting to listen and learn from what they know. And the only way I can help is if something of a deep imaginative nature gets stirred in me, then I can offer that. And so that was just this morning, and I don't know yet.
Right.
So, but that's also me at a stage in life where, you know, I get a lot of invitations.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. It's different when you know, if the stage is I have nowhere to go, or I'm not being recognized enough, then I think people have to take chances.
All right.
You know, then you want to take chances and learn on the job. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, that's how I've done it. I've done some things where I didn't have any idea what I was getting into, and then I learned from the kind of minor disaster that occurs.
Yeah, good advice.
So the other thing I think I'm a fan of is getting in the right trouble.
Uh-huh.
So, I'll go somewhere if the need is desperate or something like that, and because it could be the right trouble, and then I learn hopefully in the trouble, and
yeah,
rather than have a preformed notion or play it too safe.
Mm-hmm. Well, so we have about 10 minutes, and I did post on Facebook. I said, well, what questions would you like me to ask? So I have a few questions, if you'd be
sure.
So kind. How does the crone lead the way in these times?
Well, I would go with the story of the old salt woman.
Uh-huh.
So that's the old grandmother. And that's connected to the archetype of the wise old woman. And so there's a tremendous power there. Of course, it's a power completely denied and rejected in, you know, Western culture and where, you know, the masculine rules and all that kind of thing. But there's power, like in that old salt woman story, she has salt. And so salt is an alchemical element. And so it starts to say a lot of things. You know, the word salt comes from soul, S-O-L, comes from sun. And so the salt is connected to the sun. And that means it's connected to the source of life. And then salt is life preserving. So that would tell you that the crone has a connection to the secret sun, a warmth in life, but also has a power to preserve important things. Right now, I would imagine the crone energy has an opportunity and an absolute need, I would say, to bring back an awareness of initiation into the feminine. Mm. It's one thing to get equal pay for equal work, and it should happen. That won't affect the feminine. It might affect women, and it should. But the feminine is misunderstood, undervalued, mistreated, feared, and rejected. Unless it's in certain forms, right? Certain allowable feminine forms. So I think the path back to a greater understanding of the power, beauty, and magic of the feminine has to do with initiation. And so one of the things I would imagine, is the crone kind of energy focusing on initiation, and you could even go specifically initiation, expanding knowledge of initiation of women so that, you know, any woman who gives birth becomes a mother. There's a change of title. There's an archetypal change. That's an initiation. And imagining birth, giving birth as fully initiatory rather than a medical thing, a family thing, or a biological thing would be a quick way to empower a whole bunch of women who are nurturing the next generation. So there's a kind of a initiatory strategy that could be applied. And then the other thing I think that I've actually worked on is awakening the feminine in men. And there are many old myths about the old woman, the archetypal old wise woman, initiating the male, which is missing in the culture. You have all these, you know, these leaders trying to be tough and strong men and ready to shoot missiles all over the place and have no idea where their feminine is. And that's a tremendous danger to everybody. So that's the first thing I think of is feminine initiation from the imagination of the crone.
Beautiful. Well, we have 5 questions, so I guess I'll just choose one more. Let's see. Well, the idea of paradox came up, and I think that's really important with this sense of urgency / emergency that's here right now, and yet the soul sometimes can move in a very slow or mysterious way, and we're not in control of it. Those are my associations with paradox, but she asks, what stories are available around paradox? We can end after that.
Okay. Well, the first thing I think of is the Renaissance, where they had a saying. Renaissance was a period in Western history of tremendous change, tremendous creativity, and so on like that. And they had the phrase, festina lente, make haste slowly. So urgent, yes, but it has to also be emergent, just emergency, but emergent. And just to go back to the metaphor of birth, I mean, unless you have hospitals and all and doctors making decisions, the timing of the birth is going to be determined inside the womb. As a matter of fact, from a certain point of view, the womb collapses and that causes the birth to have to happen. So you could say we're in a period of big collapse. And that's why we feel urgency and emergency. But if we take a specific area where we want change, the collapse may have to go deeper before the full emergence can occur.
Right.
So I don't know if that helps, but paradox can create a practice of learning to hold tension also. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure what the questioner was thinking about, but that idea of creative tension and even the notion that yoga means yoke, and I know yoga is marketed as a way of getting rid of your tension, but the way it does it is, in a sense, to put you in a more creative tension, like the asana. So the trick is often how to hold a paradox long enough for a third thing to emerge.
Right.
And then trust that, because the problem with the paradox is picking one side or the other. And creative tension is always holding the paradox longer than you thought you could.
Or you wanted to.
Or certainly longer than you wanted to. Yes.
That's definitely been my experience. Well, that's wonderful, and I just really appreciate this time. I'm wondering if you want to say anything. I know you're in September, you're holding a retreat. I don't know exactly, you don't call it soul activism, but inner and outer change, if you want to say anything about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, that is about activism, and it's really that whole retreat. We do it every year, but it started from the idea that if we're out there being active and we're not taking care of our own soul and we don't know how to drop down into soulful areas together, we're not going to be as effective. That's exactly how it started. And the other piece that I was thinking of years ago when we started it was that the last public kind of somewhat known initiation process in the Western world was the initiation of women and men together. And you know, and so I was thinking that's a good thread to pick up, that there are initiatory experiences that can be shared by women and men, and that is something, you know, that's the Eleusinian Mysteries. And there's something valuable in considering that's the last time the West was consciously involved with initiation, and that there's some value in the notion that women and men could have initiatory experiences in the same context, because that's a crucible that could affect the future.
Well, deep, deep gratitude and bow to you for everything you're doing in the world and for taking time out to have this conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Anina, and good luck with everything.
Thank you.